The next case is 05-103, Jeffrey Lawrence versus Universal Underwriters. Mr. Linder.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Linder. I represent the appellants, Jeffrey Lawrence, Kathy Lawrence, and Michael Lawrence. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Today we have two issues on appeal, one of which isn't really disputed by anybody, and I don't think even anyone on the bench, and that is that the Court of Appeals cannot overrule a Supreme Court case. Can't modify it, can't do anything with it. I guess that's why they have the big granite sign out front that says the Supreme Court. They can't do that, and they did do that in this case. But what makes that even worth mentioning in my case is the fact that the case that the Court of Appeals attempted to overrule had no bearing whatsoever on the case that it had before it.
Yeah, let me ask you, Mr. Lawrence, I think that's the reason I voted to allow this case. And now I find that maybe we should be looking at a older previous case of ours, and now I find it's really not an issue except to argue about whether the Court of Appeals can overrule. That's so out of the, I mean, we don't need to talk about that, but I'm wondering now what's new in this case? What can we write in, what law can we write in this case?
Well, and along those lines, this case is a simple contract interpretation case. Okay. In fact, it is the black letter of the contract here that I believe is plain and unambiguous on the issue of coverage. It ultimately bears on what does you mean in a corporate general liability policy. Again, probably makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, but the fact of the matter is this policy actually says something about it beyond just the named insureds. And what this policy says is who is an insured, and it says you in capital letters, as all the definitional terms are in capital letters. But it goes on to have an exception shortly thereafter that says, and I've referred to it as the inclusion, but it says the insurance does not apply to injury arising out of the ownership, use, loading, or unloading of any auto while leased or rented by you, again in capitals, to others, except, and that's where this gets unusual, and it says, your customers, and your is capitalized again, your customers for a term of 2 months or less, when it temporarily replaces a customer's auto or when the customer's awaiting delivery of an auto purchased by you. In this particular case, the facts aren't in dispute. The tortfeasor in this case was a 17-year-old boy who was given a service loaner when his truck that was purchased at this dealership broke down. And the dealership took the signature of his father, dropped it on their various forms. The boy was given the keys, drives off, picks up my client who's in the back seat of the vehicle. The vehicle is in a one-car accident, and my client loses his leg. Has been through several surgeries since. And the question becomes whether or not the tortfeasor falls under the category of you, since he is your customer, as the policy reads.
Counsel, is there really an argument that there is coverage to be extended to the plaintiff here based on the language that you just read? There is the inclusion that if you're the driver of a loaner, you're covered. But then there's subsequent language that limits that coverage to the state minimum coverage in this particular situation. In other words, translated, when you're driving a loaner, you only have $12,500 worth of, because that's the state minimum, unless you've got another source of insurance to compensate you for your loss, which is the $100,000 that Nationwide paid, correct? But it,
well, the answer is no, this policy doesn't read that way. This particular policy reads that the limits of coverage set forth in the declaration page for this coverage portion is $500,000.
Then how do you account for the language that I just referenced?
Well, that was raised by the Court of Appeals, and that's omnibus clause language. And this, I conceded it from the onset. It was an argument I proffered in the trial court level in my summary judgment motion. Later, as I refined my arguments on the appeal, I conceded that issue, that the omnibus clause does not apply in this case. Just absolutely doesn't. I put it in bold letters. At the Court of Appeals, my oral argument, it was actually a somewhat unusual situation. The court kept asking me about the omnibus clause. I kept saying it doesn't apply. And everyone in the room is saying, hey, dummy, just say it applies. Come on, they want to help you out on this one. And I know Bob Boyd sitting there, and I'm saying, no, it doesn't apply. And they did that anyhow. Bob Boyd, the case that got, in effect, overruled by the Court of Appeals, is an omnibus clause case. This case, we don't have that situation. The tortfeasor wasn't insured, so he wasn't legally required to be insured under statute. He had $100,000 of his own auto insurance. But under this policy language, the coverage provision 500, which is the policy limits are set forth on the declarations page, is a $500,000 limit. And then there's an umbrella, coverage part 980, which in effect says that if you have underlying insurance, which under this policy includes policy section 500, then you're entitled to an additional $6 million, up to an additional $6 million of insurance on the umbrella. So the language about the state minimums resulted from the omnibus clause argument that was proffered, but that's not found in the policy. What also is interesting and is not found in the policy provides a section of factual situations where there would be no coverage. And again, the tortfeasor does not fall within that. I'm simply asking to look at the plain language. I made a somewhat inaccurate statement in my brief, in my proposition of law one, and that was about how the policy is to be construed. My client was not a party to the contract, and therefore construction, I don't get the benefit of that construction in an ambiguity. But my argument is there is no ambiguity on this.
It seems difficult to understand. I mean, normally when you look at a policy, you look at the insuring clause first, and then you go to the exceptions and exclusions from exceptions. And looking at the argument from your perspective, it seems as if you're going the opposite direction and avoiding the insuring clause at the very beginning. Can you address that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe I am, actually, because the way my logic works on this and the way I believe the policy reads is you look to the insuring clause, and it says who is an insured, and it says you.
And then you is defined as the named two
insured
companies.
That's right. And if you play out, all right, now we're working from the named insureds as you, but as was pointed out in Galatis, we look at the contract as a whole. We don't look at it piecemeal. And if you look to see, Galatis, in effect, stood for the proposition that we look to the named insureds unless the policy says something differently. In this case, the policy does say something differently because it uses that term, your, and to make that even less ambiguous, it's a capitalized your, and it's not defined. The word your isn't specifically defined.
You don't see it as the possessive of you,
well,
the two companies?
I do believe it is the possessive of you, but then it refers to your customers. Which the tortfeasor was, and then it's your customer using a service loaner, which it, in this case it talks about a vehicle leased or rented for less than 2 years by you to your customer. But we have that fact pattern here. Later on in the appellate process, the argument got raised that the vehicle wasn't leased or rented. Those terms are not defined in the policy, but it wasn't raised at the trial court level. It was a new argument raised at the appellate level, and then, in my case, I went to a dictionary, and it talks about consideration. And clearly, they don't give these vehicles to any person who walks off the street. They give it to their customers, whether they receive monetary compensation for repairing their vehicles or whether they receive it in the form of goodwill. They are receiving consideration for these vehicles. Therefore, I believe leased and rented has been satisfied in this case. But again, it wasn't raised until really too late in this case. I believe that argument was waived. But I hope that answered your question.
Thank you.
Okay. This case, really, intellectually speaking, isn't any more complicated than that. It's very simple for something this court would ordinarily recognize. But I would ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals, not only on the issue of overruling its case, but also on the issue of coverage on this matter. and enter a judgment finding that my client, Jeffrey Lawrence, or for that matter, Christopher Laux, the tortfeasor, isn't insured under this policy, and remand this matter for a trial on damages. And I'd like to reserve my remaining time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Lindner.
Thank you.
Mr. Scully.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Bill Scully. I'm here today on behalf of the appellee, cross-appellant Universal Underwriters Insurance Company. As you've already heard, this is a relatively simple case. It involves the interpretation of the terms and provisions of a multi-coverage policy of insurance issued by Universal. The principal focus of this case has been one of two parts. We're talking about Part 500, which is the general liability provision of the policy, and Part 980, which is the umbrella feature. I think we have to look at Part 500 first. And what brings us here today are the differences of opinion in interpreting Part 500. When this case started, there were really two opinions, the appellants and myself. After we got the trial court agreed with Universal's interpretation and found in Universal's favor on the summary judgment motion, we went to the Court of Appeals, and a third opinion, or a third interpretation of Part 500, emerged from the Court of Appeals. I'd like to address the Court of Appeals decision first. When we look at Part 500, as has been pointed out already this morning, interpreting, you have to start with the insuring agreement. And the insuring agreement says that we, meaning Universal, will pay all sums the insured legally must pay, insured being capitalized and defined in the policy. What Universal's position is that Christopher Laux, the young man driving the car that was owned by Universal's insured, was not an insured as defined in the four categories of the policy. The appellants are now saying that the term you is where Mr. Laux fits, and that couldn't be further from the truth. You, as that term is clearly defined in the policy, to mean the individuals identified in the policy declarations as the named insureds. And there's a list. Christopher Laux obviously is not in that list. Not being in that list, he does not qualify as you.
Counsel, what about Part 500 under the auto hazard number 4? Isn't that the clause that states that it's someone, in essence, driving a loaner car with the permission of the insured?
Well, then we get to the Court of Appeals analysis, which is different.
Why isn't he part of that definition or subject to that definition?
Under paragraph 4. He is not for the authority of the Bob Boyd decision from this court and the other cases that followed, and actually decisions prior to Bob Boyd from this court.
What scenario would you envision where number 4 would come into play?
Well, if we look at it, if we had an individual who was required to be insured under a certified policy, then that individual.
How can that be done if there's no identity established for certification purposes? You're talking about a random customer, identity unknown, comes in there, is allowed to have a loaner car for whatever reason. There's no possibility of certification of that individual. Would you agree with that?
Well, that person could very well bring with him a certified policy, indicating that he is certified.
His own policy.
True.
I'm talking about the insured's policy, paragraph number 4.
Would never be certified for that individual. That's correct.
All right. How would somebody that gets a loaner be covered under this policy? Or are you saying everybody that drives a loaner car is not entitled to insurance under this policy?
If the policy is not certified for that individual, that's true.
Okay, then why? You're saying then number four only kicks in if an unknown driver requests a loaner and walks through the door with a certified policy already in place, their own insurance certified policy.
If that individual is required to be an insured, yes.
All right.
And the distinction that we make here is that Christopher Lukes was not required to be an insured. The responsibility under the statute is simply to have proof of financial responsibility, that an individual maintains financial responsibility. And that can take many forms if we look at the statute. It can be a bond, it can be a certified or a certificate of self-insurance. There's a number of things that it can be. And the in this instance, he was not required to be an insured. And the point that's been missed, I think, as we've moved through this case, is that Christopher Lukes did have proof of financial responsibility. He had a policy through his family with Nationwide with 100,000 limits, much greater than the state minimum. Therefore, he did have financial responsibility, and we have to go back to the statute. Those are the terms that are used, proof of financial responsibility. The reason that Bob Boyd is still controlling is because the language of the statute, going back to the time Bob Boyd was decided, has not changed in that regard. And that's why it's still good law. The Court of Appeals, in its majority opinion, argued that it had changed, that Bob Boyd was basically nullified by the amendments that have been made to the statute over the years. But those amendments haven't changed the key items that this court looked at in deciding Bob Boyd. Excuse me. And basically, those points are that the statute still refers to proof of financial responsibility, and the statute still authorizes different methods for proving it. That being the case, Bob Boyd is still good law, and it's still applicable to this particular case. And for that reason, we would maintain that the Court of Appeals erred in deciding that Bob Boyd was no longer good law, and we would ask that the this court reverse that portion of the opinion. That being said, we get around to the position that's been adopted by the appellants here, and I've already discussed part of that having to do with the interpretation of you. The appellants cannot rely on that definition for the reasons I stated before. You is limited to the named insureds on the policy declarations. It's actually somewhat of a recent position that the appellants have adopted to use the term you. Originally, they did what was suggested earlier, and that was go to the exclusion and try to work backwards. Even if we were to accept that the exclusion somehow played a role in this case, which Universal maintains it did not, we have to look at the language of that exclusion. And it clearly states that it only applies where a vehicle is leased or rented by the insured to a customer. And in this case, it was a loaner. It was simply given to them to use and while the car was being repaired. There was no rental agreement filled out or signed. Clearly, it was not a lease. There's no leasing documents, nothing like that. There's been no money exchanged. Counsel acknowledged that consideration is part of what you would look at in interpreting rent or lease. So that exclusion simply can't apply. And for that reason, the appellant's position, they can't get past the insuring agreement.
Well, counsel, the business of providing loaners, one would presume, I think most customers presume, is built into the bill that you get when you get your vehicle back, that this is not just a charitable enterprise in terms of furnishing a loaner, that
when you buy your new vehicle or your used vehicle, and when you pay your repair bill, the proprietor who is providing that additional service is covering that in the charges.
That may be the case. I'm sure there. I'm fully aware that many dealerships that do charge a fee to give you a car. They call it a rental, or they actually give you a rental car from a rental agency, and you charge for it. In this case, there's no money passes hands. It was a consideration that was when.
Oh, but money does pass and change hands. When you bring the loaner back and pick up your car.
Well, in this particular case,
money is going to change hands.
In this particular case, it wasn't even a charge for repairs because this was a vehicle that had been purchased, saw something that needed to be fixed, and they said, no problem, bring it back. Whatever you want, we'll give you a loaner. And they fixed it. I don't believe there was even a charge for that repair. So it's not like any consideration passed at all.
Your argument on the lease or rent, I'm struggling with it because the policy language says this insurance does not apply to injury for auto while leased or rented by you. So lease or rented, as I read this, is not covered.
Correct.
And then there's the except to your customers when it temporarily replaces the customer's auto. So the exception seems to say there's no coverage when you do a long-term lease or a long-term rental or anything like that. But when you temporarily replace the auto, there is coverage. How do you explain that away? How do you get around that language?
Well, it is an exception to an exception, and I probably shouldn't even be talking about the exclusion because we don't get to the first part of it anyhow. I guess I'm only addressing it because the appellants have brought up our position.
Well, I don't have any trouble buying the fact that they're not in the list of the original insureds, the company, and all of that. But policies cover, I mean, my policy covers people I say can use my car. My language and my policy specifically says if I give permission to somebody else, they're not a named insured, they're not on the front page, but my policy has an exception that says if you loan it, you're covered. They're not a named insured here, but here's specific language that says if you lease or rent, you're not covered, but if you loan, which is temporarily replacing, certainly is a loan, you are covered. I mean, when you follow the clear language, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of dispute. And focusing on whether the you in the front page doesn't, to me, isn't the argument. It's why don't they fit this language right here? And if they don't fit this language, who does? I think Justice O'Connor asked that question. Who in the world would fit this language? Because this language doesn't say anything about certified policies.
If I could address your first question first, and that has to do with how the policy is written, and it is different than your personal automobile liability policy. And there's a good reason for that, because you have dealerships that are in the business of loaning cars, giving out cars. They can't have vehicles all over the place and be financially responsible for them.
Why not? They own the vehicles.
Well, you could never afford the insurance.
Oh. Then what does?
That's why
is the purpose of two then? Why do you have that in a policy if it doesn't apply to anything? What is the meaning of two? Who is covered under two? Give me an example of somebody who's covered under two.
And I'm sorry, two of where?
2I2. Auto while leased or rented by you, except your customers for a period of 2 months when it temporarily replaces. Who is covered under 2I2? The temporary placement.
Okay, let's go back to the definition of insured. If it's one of the individuals, or if it's someone or an entity that falls within the four definitions of insured,
those are company people, those are employees,
contract drivers.
Okay, so when would those people be having a temporary placement? Why would they have a temporary placement? They're covered. They're already covered.
Not necessarily, because there's still individuals, I think, in the second definition of insured that would not necessarily be.
So, Counselor, are you saying if these individuals lease a car, if in the course of their work
correct.
For the car agency, then they're covered under this policy. And those unknown leased cars?
No, they wouldn't be covered under the policy unless they fell within the exception to the exception, which
is a loaner.
Which is leased or rented for less than 2 months as a replacement for a vehicle.
No. That's not what it says. It says leased or rented except your customers when it temporary places. Lease or, as I read this, lease or rented is not covered. It says it is not covered when leased or rented except for temporary placement. So the exception says if it's not a lease or rent, but it's a temporary placement, there is coverage. And it's your customers. So your customers can't be people that are named on the list of named insureds. Your customers are those people that you're loaning to.
I guess all I can say is what I've said. Okay. I'm sorry if that's not enough.
I was just hoping you could explain the language better.
You've used your time, Mr. Scully.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lindner, you've saved 7 minutes of your time.
I'm going to be very brief. The language is there. It needs to be construed. You can't just disregard it. And so, therefore, I'd ask that this court overturn the Court of Appeals, enter judgment for my client, and send us back for a trial on the issue of damages. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindner. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.